Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to another Psychovertical podcast. I'm your host, Andy Kirkpatrick. As you can probably tell, I seem to finally got rid of the cold I've had for about 4 weeks. I picked up in Poland for some reason. I've just had it like constantly. Been travelling around Europe, giving it to everybody. So seem to be getting better. My voice is not as husky though, so unfortunately, don't sound as cool. I might start smoking to make up for that. So I'm back home in my unidentified country I live in. The other day, I think in my podcast last week, I was saying how I basically don't read newspapers, don't watch the news. I blocked most news websites on my computer via terminal, and I get like most of my information through sort of podcasts and things, and I tweeted something that at the moment, seen as it looks like World War III might start, it feels like a good time to have done it because my stress levels are incredibly low considering. And someone on Twitter said, "Oh, don't worry, there's no chance of being hit by a missile. Like missiles can only barely hit Tel Aviv," and I think they obviously assumed I was living in England, where I'm actually living about, I don't want to tell you where I'm living, but I'm actually living about, you know, 50 miles from Basra. So so that was kind of funny, really. So it's quite interesting when you live somewhere where, you know, the rest of the world, like loads of people I know, and like in the UK, they're all like totally freaking out, thinking they're, you know, I've got friends who've just had a baby and they're like, oh, the world's going to end. And oh, what kind of world? It's like, oh, God, get over yourself. But what's kind of cool is my wife is probably the most, I won't say the word ignorant, but there's a word for it, but I can't think of what the word it would be. The nearest to it is probably ignorant, but in like a blissful way. I shouldn't tell you this because she'll get pissed off because she doesn't like people knowing this, but she didn't actually know the Twin Towers fell down. So various things like that often come in conversations. So she's this probably one of the happiest, most positive, most able, most intelligent. She's like a relative of Ada Lovelace, you know, who invented the computer. Apparently, that's what they said on Doctor Who. But anyway, you know, she's like a super smart person, but she has this like filter where she just filters out anything that is not really relevant to her. So, she like grew up playing football and playing out with boys, and you know, like she's from Ireland. She has this like a different, very different kind of old-fashioned kind of lifestyle. Anyway, so But anyway, so recently she was at work. She like works out here as well. And someone got all this team together and they said like, okay, I just want to get you all together because, you know, there's been a lot of people talking about, you know, what's going on in the Middle East and about Iran and things. And, you know, like what we might do if Iran, you know, starts attacking or something. And Vanessa was like, what's going on? Like, what are you talking about? So she had no idea why everyone was freaking out. So, but anyway, so he says, there's that part of you that thinks that's a terrible thing. Like, oh God, to be so ignorant. And, but yeah, there's a lot to be said for it. Like, you know, she's not the happiest person I've ever met for no reason. So, but anyway, I'll try not to ramble on too much, but this podcast, I was gonna talk about something boring, but I seem to be bombarded by people directing me towards Bear Grylls climbing with Alex Honnold. So I thought I might take the opportunity to actually tell the story of me and Bear Grylls. We have an interesting parallel path where his path is going up and mine is going basically down, but it's parallel. I thought I'd tell a story about me and Bear Grylls because it's kind of an interesting, it's like an interesting story. Before I get on to it, I was gonna one of those stories where I gotta leave it right to the end. It's really shit. Like I basically went to see one of his talks or something, but I didn't actually meet the man. So, I think have you ever heard this thing that you're the result of the six people you're closest to or something? Well, like what? I was thinking recently how the odd people I've kind of met in my life, like I've been very lucky really to have had a life which was very rich with like odd people. Bear Grylls isn't one of them, but a really good example, because this came up this morning with somebody else, was like when I first moved to London, I've lived in London twice, complete shit, I'll never go live there again, unless I'm really rich. And anyway, London's not a good place to live if you don't have any money. So I lived in Peckham, which was a total shithole, and it probably isn't, and it's probably really fancy now. I think when I lived there, like Brixton was just slowly becoming a bit gentrified. This was like in the 90s. I was living there when Kurt Cobain died. I think anyway, that's the only thing I can remember being living in London was Kurt Cobain dying. So anyway, I moved to London and I got this job. This was the first job I ever had, which was like a proper job. As in, I got, you know, like you actually got paid enough money that it was actually worth doing it. Well, the other jobs I've done were not worth doing really for the money. You might as well just stay on the dole. So I got this job in this outdoor shop called Survival Aids, which was in the Euston Station. It was like on this bolted on the side of Euston Station. And I'd read Lofty Wiseman's survival book. Sorry, I'm actually recording this. For a change, I'm not recording this in my walking around the streets. I'm actually recording it in my house, my flat, so maybe some people talking. So I got this interview with this for Survival Aids, which was like a outdoor, weird kind of outdoor shop because it sold like survival stuff. This was before Bear Grylls. This was when Lofty Wiseman, who was like a famous survivalist, in the UK. I think he had like the Bush Tucker Man in Australia, and then he had like Lofty Wiseman. I don't know if America had one, but this was like, you know, pre-Bear Grylls, pre-Ramirez, pre all these people. I had this book, Lofty Wiseman's Survival Handbook, when I was a kid, and I really loved that book. It's a really good book. You can buy it now, get it secondhand. Anyway, if you've got kids, buy it for your kids. It's a really good book. And there's loads of good videos of Lofty Wiseman on YouTube. And like Lofty Wiseman was in the SAS for like, you know, like 20 something years or something, and then he was a survival instructor, and then he left and set up doing this stuff. And the I remember one of the I think he had a TV program for a while, but the one of the big things was he took someone from Blue Peter, which is like was a kids' TV, rubbished kids' TV show when I was a kid, and I was more of an ITV kind of person, not a BBC kind of person. So anyway, he took one of the TV presenters and he took him to Dartmoor or somewhere, and he taught him how to survive, and then he left him there for like a week trying to survive. And I really remember that at the end of this week, like, he was so weak, he couldn't even really walk. And that really stuck in my mind for some reason. And that is that's kind of an interesting thing about survival, that when you do come to surviving in that kind of situation where you have no food, there is absolutely no like jumping off trees or doing backflips or, you know, swimming across rivers. Like, you are totally fucked. It's like having, it's worth practicing starving yourself. Like, you can starve yourself. Like, if you just the longest I've gone without any food is, you know, like 2 or 3 days or something. But you can actually starve yourself for like, you know, a week, 2 weeks, well, at least a week without any real, you can still kind of operate to some degree. But you can't really do much, you know, like when people are starving themselves to death, they're basically just laying in bed and they just starve themselves to death. You can't really play football or anything. So, like recently, like this year, last year, I got stuck in a tent for a week without any food. I think we had like one bag of pasta, a small bag of pasta for like 8 days between two people. So we just we divide it into six portions, and we had like one portion each for 3 days, and then we didn't really have anything else to eat after that. And Vanessa was the other person, and so I literally just laid in my sleeping bag for like 7 days and didn't move once. I was like pissing in a cup and pouring out the door, and I was, you know, I didn't have a crap. I just like laid there. I didn't do one thing. Get my arm out and switch over to find NPR on the radio or something. But I didn't do anything while Vanessa was like digging holes in the snow and doing sit-ups and everything else. So anyway, but it's a good, but that really stuck in my mind, this Lofty Wiseman taking this guy, Peter, what's his name? Duncan Dares. It was an interesting thing to realise that starvation, you know, just robbed you of all your energy. So I'd read this book, and I used to make like tea out of nettles and all that kind of stuff. I really wanted to be a survival person. And I'd also, because my dad was in the Air Force, when I saw my dad, we would like go camping and things. So I had that bit of camping kind of stuff. And I'd also done some, like when I was on the dole, when I was unemployed, you know, I did like a few trips, you know, hitchhiked to the Lake District and hitchhiked around and stuff. So I had a bit of background. Like, I'd slept in, you know, like beside the motorway, like in the gullies and, you know, hedgerows and things. So I got this interview for some reason, and I went for this interview, and the manager there in the shop, he was from, he'd worked in Marks and Spencer's. I don't think he really knew anything about the outdoors at all. He was a real kind of geezer. You know, he was like, sat me down in this room. He's like, right then, you're in the jungle. What do you need? And I was like, a hammock. And he's like, you've got the job. So that was cool. And then he had a trick question. You know, he was like, what about a down sleeping bag? I was like, I think the down would get wet. And he was like, yeah. But I think I actually thought I should sell the person a down sleeping bag because they were more expensive. So I got this job. It was a great job. It was like changed my life in a way, because for the next like 10 years, all I ever did was work in outdoor shops because I didn't really have any other transferable skills or, you know, anything, any kind of qualifications. But in that shop, I met the assistant manager was a guy called Joel, and there was this guy called Jake, and everybody else in the shop basically had degrees, and they were highly educated, and, you know, in my mind, I thought they were posh, because I thought, basically, if you had your own teeth, you were posh back then. I was like totally, you know, a total ignoramus, just a total chip on my shoulder, you know, anyway. So, but it was really interesting to meet all these people. There was a guy there from America, like working there, and it was really, really great. And that was the first time I met someone who'd been to climb Denali, and so it was like really opened my mind. But so when I worked in the shop, it was when the war was going on in Yugoslavia. So we had, because we saw like military stuff and outdoor stuff, and it was like near the train station, we got a lot of news people coming in. So you had like some famous kind of news reporters coming in and the camera people, and they were getting kitted out. Because it was like really cold. It's like Yugoslavia is pretty cold in the wintertime. So we're buying all this outdoor gear. And then at the same time, you had all these like mercenary people coming in who were going out there and like joining up with different people in Yugoslavia, to the Serbs or whatever. And then you had like the British Army coming in. Then you had like the French Foreign Legion guys coming in. And so it was really, really interesting, like lots of really interesting customers in that shop. I remember there was a real change where because so many journalists were getting killed in Yugoslavia, that all of a sudden, instead of coming in buying really bright Gore-Tex jackets and stuff so people would identify them as not being soldiers, they actually started buying like camouflage clothes so that, you know, they'd be like less, it's like harder to see them. So, but just a lot of really interesting customers in that shop. I remember once there was a guy, we had this thing, it was actually called a Lofty Wiseman survival knife. It was this big knife, and it was made by Wilkinson Sword. I think it was like 180 quid. It was like in the cabinet, in a glass cabinet, like, oh God, you know, I don't think we ever really sold one. But one day, we were like, I'm standing there, and this South African guy comes in, and he goes like, see that knife? I've seen someone hecked to death with one of those knives. And I'm like, look, do you want to buy it or not? So just a lot of random customers. There was a lot of like IRA kind of bombings going on as well. And that was kind of good, because if there was like a bomb threat, then or someone found something they thought was a bomb, the whole the shop had to be evacuated. So we'd all have to like close up the shop, and we'd all have to go about 200 yards away from the train station. They'd have like a cordon, and you'd all be standing there until you could all go back again and get the all clear. And sometimes it was took so long, we had to like, you could go and sit in the pub and have a drink and things like that. So that was kind of cool. Although I remember one time we were out of the shop for ages and ages, you know, like an hour or something. Eventually, when we went back to the shop, there was actually a customer like in the shop who'd been in the changing room when we'd all had to evacuate the shop, and anyway, they were locked in there. So that was kind of funny. So we had this one customer who used to come in, and I don't really like the idea of the banality of evil, this guy like kind of for some reason I've always remembered this guy I think first of all, like, I think he wanted to buy a rucksack, and I was like showing the rucksacks, and he told me that everything he owned he had in two bags, so he could leave like a moment's notice. And I think this was before Leon, that film Leon the Assassin, a film came out. It was like no children, no pets, whatever it is. Anyway, no women, no children. Anyway, but it was, I remember thinking like, that's kind of cool. Like everything you own is in two bags. So you can just go, you know, that's kind of how I kind of live right now, actually. But yeah, I thought it was kind of cool. And then he came in the shop quite a lot, this guy, Colin, he was called, come in the shop, and, you know, he would like hang around, and we'd talk to him. And, you know, there was kind of lots of, it was that kind of place, really, because everyone was really, really friendly, and we're all kind of laid back, and we had a good laugh. And we had this guy there called Jeff. Like, Jeff, if you're still around, I do apologize for this. And Jeff was a bit weird. Like, he really wanted to be in the police, and he was a bit of a police nerd. And so if there's any shoplifters, we'd always get him to chase after them, like, quick, go on, Jeff. Because if you ever caught a shoplifter, A, they could probably stab you with a needle with AIDS in it or something, or beat you up or slice you with a knife or something. So it wasn't worth it for, you know, like minimum wage. But also if you caught a shoplifter, you might have to go to court and things. So we'd always get him to run after the shoplifter. And then when the police were in, sometimes the armed police, for some reason, used to always hang out in the shop as well. So there's always armed policemen in the shop. And he'd always be like, did you arrest the perp the other day? So he was very kind of into the whole police thing. I think I had a job in the police station, but washing up. So he always liked to tell people he was involved in policing or something. Anyway, but one day we had this, we used to get these cardboard boxes with deliveries in, and we got the assistant manager, and we put him in one of these boxes, and Jeff was like a bodybuilder, and we're like, Jeff, can you give us a hand with this box? So Jeff comes up, and he was like, yes, mind that, guys, I'll lift it up, and he's like lifting this box, and he's like, oh, it's like really struggling. And he had to go down a flight of stairs, down into the basement to carry the, anyway. So he's like, do you want a hand with that, Jeff? No, I can do it. And he's like carrying this box anyway. So basically gets down and we open the box and Joel jumps out. He's like, hey, he's like, you bastards. Anyway, so we're bullying him the whole time. It's terrible to think now, but he could have actually, you know, taken us to court or something. But anyway, the company's gone bust now. They can't do anything for us. Anyway, so one day, Jeff, you get in the box and we'll play the same trick. Anyway, so Jeff got in the box and taped it all up. And then we're like, Jeff's in the box. Anyway, so we all picked the box up and we all carried it and we threw it down the stairs. Isn't that terrible? So the box went crashing down the stairs and his arms and legs were hanging out. And I was like, you bastards. Anyway, so it's terrible things he used to do in those days in the past, long time ago. So anyway, so this guy, Colin, was in all the time, you know, kind of a bit boring, a bit weird, but he wasn't the weirdest person we had in that shop. So anyway, eventually the shop went bust, probably because we spent the whole time fucking around, and the business, anyway, it went bust and they got made redundant and decided to leave London. So I was living in Sheffield, and then one day I just get this telephone call from Joel, who's again the assistant manager. And he was like, you'll never guess what. And I was like, what? I said, remember that guy, Colin, you know, Colin, the guy who's come in. I was like, yeah, the guy with the bags. Yeah. I said, he's a fucking serial killer. And it turned out this guy, Colin, had murdered five people in London. And I think he basically would just get off with a gay guy and take him back to it, go back to the person's house. Then he would tie them up and then he would strangle them. And then that's what he did. He killed five people. And the police basically caught him because they couldn't tie all these murders together because they just thought they were just sadomasochism that had gone wrong. So he ended up eventually ringing them up to tell them that he'd done all these murders. And they were able to fit it all together. Found out it was him. And they found loads of survival aids catalogs in his house. So they came and interviewed Joel, and he told them that he had been in the shop and stuff. So yeah, kind of weird story. He actually died I think 2012 or something. So thank God for that. So not many people get to meet a serial killer. So I didn't have a time to teach him any knots or anything. But so that kind of leads on to the Bear Grylls story, really. So through working in outdoor shops, I was really interested in, I've always been a total, I think someone yesterday said I'm a very polarizing person. I have no idea why. I feel I'm a very nice person. I'm not racist or sexist. I'm not particularly... I assume I'm politically agnostic, so I don't know why people don't like me, but maybe that's one reason for doing these podcasts. When you hear me actually speaking, you realize most of the time I'm just taking the piss out of people. But I'd say one thing that is annoying about me is I can see the future. which sounds a bit, it sounds a bit up my own arse. Anyway, but I'm very, I think I am, because I'm very observant. That's why I'm good at writing and why I, you know, make a living as a writer. Because I have to be very, it's probably, I don't know where it comes from, but I'm very good at observing things. And I'm very good at detail. Like, it's, I've got this kind of obsession with really, really tiny things that people don't see, so. They always said, like, Napoleon, they said Napoleon was, I'm not saying I'm like Napoleon, but they were saying Napoleon was, his advantage over everybody else was he could see 2 years into the future. And it's actually quite easy to see into the future. So you just have to notice what the hell's going on. Most people don't pay any attention. So this obsession with, like, detail and little things meant that when I was working in this shop in Derbyshire outside, I was basically end up finding this company, OneSport, which were in France, which no one had probably ever heard of before. But they were basically making like boots for like Antarctica, and they're just like making boots, sort of high altitude stuff. But they were super obscure company. I think they were making shoes, like fishing shoes for Patagonia. That was their main deal, I think, at the time. And anyway, so I got in touch with them, and I got a pair of these OneSport high altitude boots. And at the time, like the boot everyone was wearing at high altitude was a like a Scarpa high altitude Vega, or a Sportiva, or a Coflac sort of Arctic Ultra, with like a neoprene or like a foam kind of overboot, which was a really crap system. It like didn't keep your feet warm, and loads of people used to get frostbite because wearing that kind of boot system. So anyway, these boots, it was actually two layers of foam, and it was kind of flexible, and looked a lot warmer. So we ended up being like the sole company that was selling those in the UK. I mean, we ended up selling them all over the place because, you know, no shop stocked them anywhere. I don't know anywhere in the world that was selling these boots. I don't know how anyone got hold of them. And probably the claim to fame was they were the boots that Beck Weathers was wearing on Everest when, you know, basically lost his fingers and his nose and everything else, but his feet were fine. So anyway, so we're selling these boots, and we started selling, you know, I guess it was kind of at the beginning of when Everest and that kind of stuff was like becoming a thing where ordinary people were starting to do it. And so we started having lots of people coming to the shop from all over the place to get hold of gear. We started working with Pete Hutchinson Designs, who made down suits and stuff. And I ended up like working for Pete, doing like some design work. And so that was like really cool. And, I get this call from some posh sounding guy who wanted like two pairs of these boots, and they wanted them like yesterday as usually. And anyway, so I managed to send them off down to London, and they went off. And anyway, it turned out they were for this guy Bear Grylls. And I remember like when he came back, he was supposed to be like the youngest person to have ever climbed Everest or something, or the youngest to go up and come back down again. I think in the book, I think in the American version of his book, it's called like The Kid Who Climbed Everest, which when you're 21, you're not really a kid, but anyway. So that was kind of interesting. So I worked in this shop, and then eventually I was climbing, and I got like, was climbing enough and making enough money to stop working in the shop. And then I was like, you know, starting on the road of doing slideshows and talking and making writing and stuff. And so you had this, I had this kind of parallel world really with Bear Grylls for a while. It's kind of interesting. I think, you know, I never actually bumped into him, but, You do a talk somewhere and they say, oh, we had this guy Bear Grylls who climbed Everest, or you do like a corporate talk, and you felt like this Bear Grylls character was out and about. He's like one of these, you know, there was it probably was the way like in those days, you know, in the 90s, you didn't really have these like professional motivational speakers, you know, where you meet a young person, they're like, what do you want to be? And like, I want to be a motivational speaker. It's like, what are you going to do? What, you know, so they're basically, that's what they want to do. And then just think of something they can do to talk about it rather than doing something and thinking, oh, maybe I could talk about this. So, that was all. So Bear was doing his thing, after my thing. And then I think what the breakthrough was I think Bear actually paid to a pilot or something for Discovery or one of these things, like survival kind of stuff. So he had this kind of, I think I probably read his book by then. He seemed like a nice person. And I think you had like Ben Fogle at the same time. Sometimes get the two of them mixed up, you know, one's a wanker, one's a twat. And he had these two kind of posh kind of people. And I think that has always been a problem for me. Is basically like Ben Fogle's a bit different because he wasn't in the army, but they really like this kind of like army, you know, Sandhurst, you know, someone who knows how to wear brogues, you know. Anyway, that kind of person is like the perfect kind of out. He's like this like romantic, you know. So I'm more of like a Fred Dibner kind of person, you know, more grafting up a chimney or whatever, like, you know. So this TV program came out, and there was Bear Grylls, and in a way, like Bear Grylls kind of became, it'd be interesting seeing those old programs now, but he became sort of fully formed. Like he appeared just at the right time when the internet was kind of starting to appear and social media was like still probably 5 years ahead, but he was kind of getting there. He was doing more and more sort of corporate-y kind of stuff. And he's kind of, in a way, I'd say he's like the complete opposite to me. Like he was this person with like this beautiful wife and, you know, had like young babies and he lived on a barge. You know, his dad was a Tory MP and, you know, obviously had like a lot of sort of privilege and wealth and connections, and where I was like kind of the total opposite. So as our paths diverged and he became this, you know, is worth, I think the Bear Grylls brand is worth, you know, like hundreds of millions of dollars, apparently. It's like worth, I think he's worth like 30 million or something. So as he kind of was becoming this kind of thing, I was just doing my thing. And, but for me, like, I think what's interesting is good to think about Bear Grylls is that he basically climbed Everest sometime in the 90s or something, and he's been like trading on that for basically like 30 years, you know. And he had like a brief stint, like 6 months or something, as a territorial SAS guy. Like I made a joke that the unit he was in is not really the SAS, it's like 21 SAS or something. You have to like dig into this kind of stuff, and I'll come to that in a second. But they call them the rubber daggers, but it's kind of unfair because there's still, you know, people in those SAS things have actually been killed in wars and stuff and in Iraq and things. So anyway, but I always felt there was like a little bit of dishonesty. Well, it's not dishonesty, but his big thing was he broke his back parachuting. And as you on active duty, and as you get older, you meet a lot of people with broken backs, and it's probably it's a, you know, how badly was it broken, you know? And yes, the doctor said you'd never walk again, but they say that to everybody. You get like fucking Veruca and they say you're never going to walk again. So and also the use of the word active, you know, on active duty. I think he was probably on like a skydiving holiday in Africa, South Africa or something. So it's a very interesting thing, is to learn the, you know, like not lying, but you're just sort of spinning the truth a little bit. And I think that's a very different thing between like a working class person and, you know, like an upper middle class, you know. I think Bear's probably like semi-aristocracy. He's up there with kind of Ranulph Fiennes and things. Is that like a working class person, they would go to the moon on a rocket, you know, they would land on the moon and they'd come back again. And someone would say, what have you done? You know, what do you used to do? And you'd be like, I used to work on rockets or something. But then, someone like a posher person who worked in, the kitchen for a week doing washing up, he would say, oh, I was heavily involved in the NASA, with NASA or something. And it's a good technique to learn, really. Instead of just like this is probably my main point about Bear Grylls, is instead of like getting pissed off with people like Bear Grylls and feeling like, oh, how unfair that they kind of spin these things that they were on active duty and the special forces and all that kind of stuff. It's to kind of like learn from them. It's just like you don't have to lie, but you can just, just play around with the, that's your interpretation of what's going on. So like perhaps I even do that, without saying, the reason I don't tell you where I'm living is because it's just not a good idea. But it creates like a mystique, So mystique is a very, very important thing really in life is. So, recently my house burnt down. Well, this year my house burnt down. I've never told it. I don't really make a big thing of it because that's my mystique, there's some things I don't want to share, but I'll share everything else. So Bear became like more and more and more famous, like increasingly famous. And the more I didn't become famous, I had this thing, this is very common, where it's like, why is he famous and why am I not famous? Like, I'm doing this really hard shit. Like, I'm doing the hardest big wall in the Alps, and I'm, doing all sorts of stuff and soloing the hardest route on El Cap and soloing and blah, 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 blah. I'm funnier than him. I'm not as good looking as him, but I can stand on a stage, and I know that when I'm on a stage, I'm a better speaker than him. Like, I'm more interesting than him, and all these kind of things. And it's like, why is he famous? Why am I not famous? And you just get, and I remember there's other people. There's other like posh people I would like identify them. Like, another one is Ben Saunders. Like, Ben, you might be listening to this podcast, but Ben was another one. He's like he's like this posh guy. He knows how to wear brogues, and he's got like a blazer, and he goes to the Royal Geographical Society. He's like, why can he fucking, why is he getting talking to Google and Microsoft? And why is he on a TED? Why is he doing a TED talk? Why am I not doing that? But luckily, not so much with Bear, but with other people, I luckily managed to turn a corner where I was like, look, instead of being like this kind of just like working class, like, I could have been someone and all that kind of stuff. It's just actually analyze what they're doing and copy it, like try and just work out. Just so when my brain is good at, taking a complex thing and dismantling it down into its component parts and rebuilding it and working out how it works. So I'd look at someone like Ben Saunders, and I was like, well, Ben Saunders has got one of his websites, and he's got like this, he's on this thing called Twitter. And so the reason I went on Twitter, so I was like a very early adopter of Twitter, like 2008 or something, was like Ben Saunders had Twitter, and he had this, he probably had like, he was on Facebook. And so whatever Ben Saunders did, I would do exactly the same. So in fact, my very first website I ever did, I realized if you went into like, you could see like the code of the website. I just copied all the code off all his pages, and then I banged them all up. I somehow worked out what a server was and how you put the code up there, and then it appeared, and how you got images to appear and folders and all that kind of stuff. So I actually just completely copied Ben's website to every bit of it, and then just put my own pictures in and put my own words in. But it was exactly the same as Ben's. And this is a great credit to someone like Ben Saunders. He actually emailed me and said, you seem to have somehow copied my website, because you've even copied the tracking code or something, I know it's you. So I deleted that bit. And emulating the people you despise, like Ben fucking Saunders. No offense, Ben. I remember probably the same kind of time, I did a talk in Scotland, and I remember I was like climbing on the on the crag, like winter climbing, and it was getting time to go, and we were just, anyway, we ended basically getting to this venue and had all my climbing gear on still, and I had to run into the toilets and change out of it and do my talk and all that kind of stuff. And then I lost a lot of slides, I left them on top of the car and drove off and I lost them. And anyway, it's a disaster. But my dad was with me. My dad's very good at giving sort of advice. And he was like, what do you want to do in your life? And I'm like, oh, I just want to talk. I want to like do slideshows and be like, do stand on the stage. That's what I really like doing. He was like, well, what do you think you're worth? And I said, oh, I think I'm worth like £1,000 to do a slideshow. He said, well, if you want to be worth £1,000, you got to look like you're worth £1,000, which is basically like get your act together. So I kind of copied, like I'm not really good at copying. I basically can never be like Bear Grylls or Ben Saunders or Al Humphreys or all these other, you know, they're all their unique individual selves, but all of them are copying off each other to some extent. Like, why is he doing this? Why is he doing that? So that's a good sign of successful people, is he just like steal everything of everybody else. But somebody somewhere is like the original, you know, the original thing, but don't know where that is. So I really kind of changed. I think in my second or first podcast, I was talking about how I got into public speaking, and that's basically what I did. I ended up becoming sort of very successful, I had to just bypass most of the corporate kind of stuff because I just don't look like Ben or Bear Grylls or whatever. I'm just not good at that kind of thing. I look like a bag of shit, basically. I look like a lumberjack or something. I'm not going to stand in front of Google and no one's going to listen to me. So I basically made my own arrangements. I ended up like talking on stages in theatres and became like very successful at that kind of thing, like a stage performer, basically. So in the end, I ended up being as famous as as successful as I'm ever going to be without ever being on television. So basically, to people like Bear and to Ben and things. So although I could learn to love like Ben and people like that, my beef with Bear, it just became a little bit of an obsession, and I would never miss any opportunity to slag him off, basically. And I had this thing that he was a fake, and you know, he wasn't really in the SAS, and you know, he was, you know, like Everest was a long time ago, and it's not that hard, and there was and all this kind of stuff, and I guess because I always. Like climbing is a weird thing. Like you're kind of in. There's like a tyranny of being honest, basically, and not. It's very kind of, maybe it's like a Yorkshire thing, a very UK thing, really. But you have to be really honest and you have to be genuine, and you can't ever be, you know, you just can't get away with being up your own arse, basically. So, but you can really in that kind of different world, the corporate world, people can do it really. I wrote stuff about Bear. I'd say horrible things about him. Like on stage, I would make stupid jokes. Like I think if you look on YouTube, there's a video. I think it's called like, is it When Hell? No, it's Inappropriate Climbing. Or one of those videos. And it's like I'm making jokes about being Bear Grylls down a crevasse, and you know, like Bear Grylls is like. He's really, you know, he's really good at like, he's always like hunched over, and he's always out of breath, like, right then, you know, catch it, kill it, fuck it, or whatever it is, like whatever he says. So I remember I started like getting all these people following me who actually worked for Bear Grylls, and I often wonder, like, are they actually following me on social media just to keep an eye on me or you know, what's going on? And I probably overstepped the mark in because you do kind of forget that like Bear Grylls is a real person. You know, you kind of, you know, he is a law, you know, when you got 30 million quid in the bank, who gives a fuck what people think? I think you got to take that kind of James Blunt kind of thing. Look, whatever you say, I'm the one with the three models, you know, in Brazil, and you're not. But then what's weird is the reason I ended up with Vanessa, my current wife, my future ex-wife, is She invited Bear Grylls to give a slideshow in Ireland, and she also invited me. Now, Bear Grylls, I think his fee was £100,000 plus two first class tickets, and I think I was €1,000. So I got the gig, and I turned up there, and met Vanessa, and the rest is history. So whatever happens with Bear Grylls, like because he's got overinflated prices, pricing structure, I will always owe him that, like, which is an amazing thing. Anyway, so, but what is weird was, I remember when I first met Vanessa, like, I was in a bit of a low point in my life. I was in the dip of life, and all she talked about was Bear Grylls, how she liked Bear Grylls. And I was like, oh God, this loot, you know, she doesn't know, like, the Twin Towers fell down, but she knows, like, everything the Bear Grylls ever done. And she even had a signed piece of paper from Bear Grylls on a wall, like in a frame. And it said, never stop exploring, which is, you know, that's good, that unique. So, you know, I was like, Christ almighty, how have I ended up with this woman who loves Bear Grylls? And she'd been to the UK and seen Bear Grylls on stage, and, you know, had all his books and read, you know, every, you know, anyway, so super big, the biggest Bear Grylls fan in the world, really. Also, I thought, So I get with Vanessa, move to Ireland, eventually get married and all that kind of stuff. And the Bear Grylls thing, because Vanessa liked him so much, I kind of decided that it wasn't fair, really. It was, I owed him something. I owed him enough to back off, because sometimes when you, like, slag someone off, and other people join in, you're like, oh, that sounds a bit nasty. The way, when you say it, it sounds a bit nasty. It's a bit like, you know, if someone thinks you're making, so a classic example, if someone thinks you're saying something which is racist, but you're not, but then someone who is racist starts chiming in with you, and you're like, actually, I'm not, you know, that wasn't actually racist, that, but you do sound a bit of a racist person. So it was a little bit like that sometimes. Like, some people, like, they're, it wasn't, I guess it's never about Bear, it's about something else in your life, isn't it? It's like you felt like you're badly done to, or, you know, the idea of, like, privilege is basically, you know, socialism is all based on, is just like fucking hating people who've got more than you have, really. So, and that's Bear Grylls, hating Bear Grylls is a kind of a form of sort of socialism, I guess. So, and his dad was a Tory MP, doubly bad. So, anyway, so living in Ireland, give Bear Grylls, you know, he's everywhere, doing everything. It's like, how much money is too much, Bear? You know, like, there's knives everywhere, and sausages, socks. You know, he's on tour, he's like space, it's, you know, satellites with his name on it. And I just have to just ignore it. Anyway, but then one day Vanessa comes in and she's like, oh, guess what? I've got, like, Bear Grylls is coming to Dublin, and he's going to be on the Late Late Show, and they're going to record it live, and I've got, like, tickets to go and see him for both of us. And it's just, and isn't that amazing? I was like, oh, Christ almighty, I can't believe it. I'm going to have to go and see Bear Grylls. Like, oh, this is terrible. So I just, like, tweeted somewhere like, oh, guess what? You know, I'm going to finally meet Bear Grylls. Can't believe it, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so the next day Vanessa was at work, and she was a teacher. And there's a telephone call, and they go, oh, there's a call here from RT, the TV company in Ireland. And she answered the phone, and it's like, hi, this is the producer of the Late Late Show. We've been made aware by Bear Grylls' team that your husband will be attending this live interview with Bear Grylls. And that he may be disruptive, and we'd just like to tell you that there will be security there on the night. So Vanessa's like, oh God, no, he's not going to say anything. He's just been a gobshite, and oh, sorry. Anyway, so she feels like totally, like, anyway. So she comes home. She's like, oh God, what are you doing? Like, don't tweet anything, don't say anything. You know, basically she says that most of the time anyway. But don't do anything. Like, oh God. So she, anyway. So I'm on my best behavior. So the night comes, and we get all our clothes on, all, you know, we're not quite naked, but we put our fancier clothes on for Bear Grylls. put my brogues on and all that kind of stuff. And anyway, so we arrive at the studio, and I don't know if you've ever been to a studio, but there's like, you know, it's like a big thing, big building with all these people there, like, you know, get free tickets. They're all, it's like a big night out for people. So anyway, we're all sitting there. Oh no, we're going in, and they're like checking everybody off, and they go, "Oh, Andy and Vanessa, oh, we may have to come and talk to you before you go in there." I was like, "Oh, Christ Almighty!" So anyway, so we sit down, and ladies and gentlemen, please make your way through into the studio. And as we're going through, like someone comes up and says, "Oh, Andy, Vanessa, could you come with me, please?" And I thought it was going to be the, one of these things where you start walking along down all the corridors, and this door opens, and it's like the fire exit, and they just throw you out. So anyway, so we're walking along, and they're going through these doors, across the studio floor, up some stairs, down a corridor, and I suddenly had this, like, premonition of what was going to happen. And it was just like, oh, please, no, don't let this happen. Anyway, the doors open, and there was Bear Grylls and his manager, just the two of them, and it was just, the assistant disappeared, and there was just the four of us. Now, this is something I will never forget, and this is a great lesson in life. What Bear Grylls did, he put out his arms, he said, Vanessa, so nice to meet you. And he came up and he gave her a hug. He was going to give one of these kind of like mwah, mwah, one of these kind of like, you know, like posh person kind of little kiss things. But she was like all over him. She was like dry humping his leg, everything else. She couldn't believe it, like the Bear Grylls. Anyway, so, but that is a fucking cool move. Like, how could you ever hate someone who would make your wife feel so great, and like meeting him, a hero? Like, he doesn't know who the fuck she is, but you know, he knows who I am, but he doesn't know who she is, but he makes her feel like she's special, and the few people, you know, in her life who's made her feel like that. So anyway, so he's, and then I can't remember his name now, but his manager like shakes my hand, and he's like really, really nice. Oh, nice to meet you. Anyway, then Bear, like, you know, Bear manages to like peel Vanessa off, you know, he gives her a bit of mace or something, uses SAS, I think it's a black belt in karate, and he gets rid of her. And he turns to me and he's like, "Oh, Andy, I'm a huge fan of yours." And he's like, I'm shaking his hand, and he's like, "Oh, I've heard you've climbed the wolf's tooth, you know." And I was like, "What the fuck's he talking about? What's a wolf's tooth?" And then obviously there's a blank expression. He was like, "Ulvatana in Antarctica." I was like, "Oh yeah, Ulvatana, yeah." And but I just had this like total kind of shit-eating grin all over my face, you know, like. And I was just like, oh God, this is like terrible. Like, what am I going to, I didn't know what to say. I was just like, ha. And Vanessa was like talking, and he was like being really charming and nice and everything else. Everybody was laughing. I was like, ha. And I was like, don't be one of those assholes. You know, like when you eventually meet Adolf Hitler and you're like, oh, Mr. Hitler, I actually quite like you. And you know, all that stuff people say, I don't agree with them. You know, I was like, don't be one of those people. So I was like, oh, Bear, you do realize that, I once tweeted that, you know, whenever I slag you off on social media, I always lose followers, but as a result, the average IQ of my followers goes up. And he was like, ha, yes, we read that, yes. So anyway, but he was like really, really, he was like really nice. He was like, you know, you just could not help but think this is a nice person. Like, it's not his fault that he's so fucking successful, is it? And and you realize that his manager, he was like totally sharp, he was on it, like basically Bear Grylls has got like a really good team of people around him. But anyway so he was nice to Vanessa, and we're talking, and then eventually he's like, oh, it's time to go now. So nice to meet you. And he goes off, and we take our seats, and we're like sitting there, and the recording starts, and the TV presenter gets on and sits down, and he's like, "And now, ladies and gentlemen, Bear Grylls." Anyway, so Bear Grylls comes in, and people went fucking crazy. Like, people were throwing scouts at him, and badges and knives, and "Oh, Bear, and people were like trying to run across the studio to get him to sign like a, you know, a woggle or something. He was like bear, and I was like, oh Christ Almighty. And I realized surrounded by all these like crazy fucking bear crazy people, and I need some like bear suppressant, bear mace or something. Anyway, so anyway, everyone just finally calms down. They spray everybody down, calm them down. Anyway, so he sits down there, and I was just like, God, he's like so professional. Like, he had his nice clothes on. He was looking like he was, you know, had his stuff on his shit on his wrist and all that kind of stuff, and Help for Heroes and everything else. And he was like, kind of, he's like basically a safe pair of hands. And I remember once going to like Sports Personality of the Year in London, and it was the year when Bradley Wiggins won for after winning like the Tour de France. And like Bradley Wiggins is a really interesting character, but when you saw him on the stage, he was fucking terrifying. Like, cause he didn't know what, no one knew what he was going to say, what he was going to do. And then you've got like Gary Lineker, who's like, you know, it should have been it's like a TV goalie, basically. He's not going to drop the ball. He's just this, you know, he's exactly what he says on the tin, where Bradley Wiggins isn't. And Bear Grylls is what he says on the tin. He's like, you know, nice Christian, you know, blah, blah person, like a survival person. And anyway, so all that, all that kind of stuff. And then he was like, oh, basically, you know, as soon as I finish this, I have to get in a helicopter and have to fly back to London. And then I got one night in London, and then I have to fly off to China for something. And I kind of realized that I would not want to be Bear Grylls. Do you know what I mean? Like I had this idea that at one point in the audience, at one point, everyone was going so crazy. He looked in the audience and he could see me, and he probably thought, out of all these people in this audience who fucking would jizzle over me, like, you know, like would you know, they would just, you know, would eat me probably if they could. The only person I'd probably like to hang out with is the guy who doesn't like me. And but I do like you, Bear. But it was, you know, like basically he's trapped. He's kind of trapped as being Bear Grylls. So he hasn't done any like significant other adventure things that are in the real world. He's just the brand. He's just a brand Bear Grylls. He can't do anything anymore apart from be Bear Grylls. He can't be Edward anymore. Edward Grylls. He's just Bear Grylls. And you get on this sort of treadmill. Maybe next time I talk, I'm going to talk about this idea of like locked in life syndrome, which loads of people seem to have, where you just can't get out of it. You know, like he has to be Bear Grylls. And I think the pressure of the reality of being Bear Grylls is very different, I think, to the Bear Grylls we see, like the pressure on his wife, marriage, his kids, all that kind of stuff is bad enough for most people, but for Bear Grylls, I reckon it's like really, really difficult. So anyway, so that was, it was really amazing. I knew already that you have to look at these people and know the burden that it, you know, like all that money isn't worth anything really if you're not free. You know, you're kind of just a slave really to this system you've created. All these people you employ, you can't just like sack them all off and say, I'm not doing it anymore. You know, you have to keep going. And until you can't keep going anymore. So it made me feel really happy. It made me happy to be who I am, and I wasn't better looking, and you know, I didn't look so good doing press-ups naked in the snow and stuff. And it kind of, I don't know, it made me really respect Bear Grylls. Now, I know some people will be really disappointed that I'm saying these words, I respect Bear Grylls. I'm not saying respect him as a survivalist. I'm not respecting him as a climber. I'm not respecting him. I do respect him as a businessman, and I respect him, and I do actually respect him as a human being, right? You know, and I even respect him as a Christian. And I used to think, what an idiot, what a tosser being a Christian. You know, now I'm living in like a fucking, you know, I always joke I'm Islamophobic, but I actually live in an Islamic country. So I actually have come to terms with religion. And I'm not a bigot about religion anymore. So even the religious stuff, Bear, you know, you've got a pass from me. But mainly he's got some really good skills, and other people, having met Bear Grylls and having spent years studying him and has got rid of all the bits that I could never be like Bear Grylls, you do see other people on the TV trying to be Bear Grylls. But no one can be Bear Grylls. There is only really one Bear Grylls who can be like Bear Grylls, and that's Bear Grylls. And when you go climbing in the quarry somewhere, or you're outdoors on the hill, all those little kids, you know, they don't want to be Nick Bullock, or you know, and they don't, you know, They want to be Bear Grylls, and they will grow out of it eventually. But he is a positive force in the world. And yes, we can get upset that he goes caving without a helmet on, or does all this kind of shit, and is all kind of make believe, and he doesn't know the Latin names of all this stuff. I have this hope for Mr. Grylls. If I was going to be mentoring him, is he needs to like move the brand along. Like, I don't know if anybody saw the series The Island, which I thought was like really, really good. A really good series. The less Bear Grylls, the better it was, really. But, you know, I think Bear has to move into, you know, not become edgy, not change from being Bear Grylls, but I think he has to eventually, you know, when you go and see The Lord of the Rings, when you first saw The Lord of the Rings, it was fucking amazing. It was like, wow, this is the greatest film ever made. But now you watch, it's like a pastiche of itself or something. It's like, oh my God, this is terrible. And so you don't want Bear Grylls to end up like that. You need to, you know, anyway, don't know how you do that, Bear. You know, you're the expert. So so there's a little aside to this story, I want you to say this story because I don't want to get killed. But I was told a story that the certain special forces kind of unit were never keen on Bear saying he was in the SAS, probably because, but you know what's interesting is like Bear is the only person who says he was in the SAS or Special Forces who's like famous in the UK who hasn't probably killed anybody, well, not intentionally anyway. And because you have got this like the rise of like, it's like, be careful what you wish for, because you because Bear Grylls is basically it's all an illusion. But now we have actually got people who do kill people and know how to kill people, and kind of pretty edgy, dangerous kind of characters. And I don't really like it that much, I've decided. I don't really want, you know, and if you, and you had the, I don't know, I feel like it's a sign of something that's missing when you get people like that. Like, Bear's not a sign of anything missing. Bear's just like entertainment. He's like Blue Peter, basically. Where now you've got something which is more, it's more like Black Mirror, I think. So that's something for another time. Anyway, but so this SAS unit, the SAS didn't like that Bear was saying he was in the SAS. So one night, apparently, this may not be a true story, they got over to his island where he was living, and they managed to break into his house, or get into his house, probably wasn't locked anyway because it's an island, and left a note on the table, on his kitchen table, saying, if you tell anyone you're in the SAS again, we're going to come back. Now, I'm sure this was a joke, a little SAS kind of joke. And anyway, ever since then, I've never heard him say he was in the SAS. I've always heard him say he was in the... he was in the Special Forces, which he was in the Special Forces, but not technically in the SAS. And so I told this story in the Brecon Beacons, which is where the SAS are based. And anyway, so I finished the story, and then I was at the end, I was like signing books and things, and this huge, huge guy comes up to me, and he's like, "I'd just like to tell you there were many members of the regiment in the audience this evening, and that is a true story." So we've got this story. And then about a year later, I started getting contacted by the Daily Mail or, you know, the Sunday Times, or one of these journalists. And they'd heard this story I told on the grapevine. And they basically were looking for shit about Bear Grylls. And because I'd shit talked Bear Grylls so much, they obviously thought I was an ally. And I would like spill the beans and tell him something that would, you know, bring him down, because he's like, you know, if anyone needs bringing down, it's someone like Bear Grylls. We need to find out about affairs with midgets and all this kind of stuff. And but I never replied, because no matter how much I was, you know, I wasn't keen on Bear Grylls in the past, I actually, as I say, I respect him as a person, and that's not what you sort of do to people. So yeah, avoid the journalists. So I had some chips cooking in the oven, and I think they might all be burnt now. Anyway, I don't want to burden you with all my problems. That's how the house burnt down. Actually, the house burnt down because someone was praying to God, nothing to do with me, and set fire to the house, and the house burnt down. So yeah, that's the downside of religion. So anyway, so thanks for listening to the podcast. Don't forget that on a Tuesday, I actually have a less rambly, just talking about climbing related stuff. Basically, I see myself as to be happy in life, you have to serve somebody else, and I feel I'm serving climbers. So that's my penance every Tuesday. I have to sort of do questions and answers and a little thing about techniques. And that's called higher education. So if you look on the list of things, the first one was last week about prosthetic loops and things. Really, really exciting if you're into that kind of stuff. So if you want to contact me, I've had like quite a lot of emails. I talked a bit about mental health for some reason. Like, people love talking about mental health, don't they? Christ almighty. Don't talk about mental health. You just get all these like crazy people getting in contact with you. But if you are crazy, then don't get in contact with me. So, but if you want to get in contact, there's links on my website, Andy Kirkpatrick, Andy-Kirkpatrick. Everything's a bit pretentious having the word hyphen, but anyway, Andy/a line in the middle, .com or social media, Twitter, all that kind of stuff. If you like this podcast and you want to hear more, like, I'm getting in more into it. You know, Joe Rogan was shit when he started. And I'm not saying as much. But I don't want your cash. Yeah, I know you want to give me loads of money. But if you like it, then the best thing you can do is just get on social media, tell people, listen to this story about Bear Grylls. It's fucking terrible. Anyway, so just tell people, if you like it, just share it. It doesn't cost you any money to share something. You know, like, I may be like a polarizing person. I don't know why. I think the people who think I'm polarizing just get fucked, basically. So anyway, so if you like it, share it. If you don't like it, then don't worry because you didn't get this far. So anyway, so until next time, Andy Kirkpatrick signing off.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.